I'm reading from the New American Standard text. The New American Standard text. James A. Garfield was the 20th president of the United States. He was inaugurated on March the 4th, 1881, and was assassinated only 4 months into his term, and he died about 2 months later. His tenure as president is actually the shortest of the terms of president. William Henry Harrison died in only his 32nd day of presidency. But what most people may not know about James Garfield is that he not only was a member of the church, but he was also an elder in the Lord's body. And it was he who is reported to have said, "I resigned the highest office in the land to become president of the United States." You know, I think Garfield was right. I do believe that serving as an elder in a local congregation is the highest calling in life. The importance of having elders in local churches cannot be overstated. And I want to get to this right here. I think we can see the importance of it in the first missionary journey of Paul. The Apostle Paul left Antioch of Syria, and then he sailed to the island of Cyprus. And from Cyprus, he sailed up to Perga in Pamphylia, and then traveled on to Pisidian, Antioch, Iconium, Lystra, and Derbe. From Derbe, they retraced their steps, and maybe it is the purpose of doing that that is stated for us in Acts chapter 14 and verse 22 and 23, where the Bible says that they went back strengthening the souls of the disciples, encouraging them to continue in the faith, and saying, "Through many tribulations we must enter the kingdom of God." When they had appointed elders for them in every church, having prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord in whom they had believed. Elders in every church was important to the purpose of God. And I think we can see this reflected in what Paul did on this first missionary journey. And if it's that important to the Apostle Paul, it certainly should be important to us as well. In later explaining the reason why he left Titus in Crete, the Apostle Paul said, "I left you in Crete," and this is the New Century version of this, "I left you in Crete so you could finish doing the things that still needed to be done, and so you could appoint elders in every town as I directed you." And you can see there is that has kind of been expanded on with regard to the translation. You can see, I think, the thought of what the Apostle Paul is talking about. He left Titus in Crete because there's something that had been left undone that needed to be done. Why? We're not quite sure. It may be that there wasn't yet men qualified to serve. But he left Titus there so that he could appoint men to serve in that capacity. Again, having qualified elders in every local church is important to the purpose of God. And I don't think this is often, I think that it's often not reflected in our attitude. There was a man opposing an effort to appoint elders in one church. He said, "We've never had elders. We don't need elders. We've got along fine without elders, and so we're not going to appoint elders." Someone really should have recorded that man's words and later played them back to him again, because I know the man, and I would like to think, I would really like to think that he's a better man than that. But still, that's the attitude that a lot of people have had over the years. Now, in the same way that he was concerned about the organization of local churches in the southern Galatian region and on the island of Crete, Paul was concerned about the maturity of the organization of the church in Ephesus. Because that's what you read here in 1 Timothy chapter 3. You read about the establishment of elders. You read about the qualifications of elders. You read about the qualifications of deacons. You read about the qualifications of the women, of the servants of God. And tonight what we're going to do is focus on two things. We're going to focus on the organization of the church, period. I want us to think about that, because that's underneath, lying underneath all of this. And then we're going to focus on the qualification of elders specifically, concluded by looking at the last statement that Paul makes here in verse 16, if we can. Well, in the first century, Jesus sent forth his apostles to preach the Great Commission. We're well aware that Jesus said in Mark 16:15-16, "Go into all the world, preach the gospel to all creation. He who has believed and has been baptized shall be saved." That was a message that they took throughout not only Palestine, but then throughout the Roman world. And those who obeyed the gospel, they were added to the Lord's church. They were members of the Lord's universal body that he said he would establish in Matthew chapter 16 and verse 18. And in Acts 2 and verse 47, you read about them being added. In 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 13 says, "For by one Spirit are we all baptized into one body." Now, regarding this universal body, I think it's important for us to understand that there is no earthly organization. Each Christian is a spiritual stone in this spiritual temple of God. He is a member of the body. You read about that in 1 Peter 2 and also in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and Ephesians chapter 1 and 2. And having no earthly organization, it has no earthly function. God has not given the universal church a collective function to do here upon this earth. That's not to say that the universal church doesn't have any function at all, because we as individual Christians are members of that body, and we certainly have things to do that God has given us to do in responding to His Word. And so the universal church is a very active body of people. It's just not collectively so. But in His church, according to the apostles' guidance and direction, Christians banded together in local churches. You see it in Jerusalem in Acts chapter 5 and verse 11, and in Acts chapter 8 and verse 1. You see it in Antioch in Acts chapter 13 and verse 1. You see it alluded to in Acts chapter 14 and verse 23 as Paul went through the southern Galatian regions. Colin Caldwell gave me a really good definition of a local church many years ago, and I've kind of hung on to it because I think it's exactly right. When he says it's a group of people who decide to do together the things that God has given them to do together. And I like that definition of what a local church is. So these saved people, Christians, in any given locality were organized into a local church, and that by God's direction. And when they were mature, they were organized under elders to oversee, preachers to preach, teachers to teach, deacons to serve, and other members to function as they can for the building up of the body of Christ. Ephesians chapter 4, verses 11 through 16. And so this is the organization of the local church. God gave the church this organization. And it's really important for us to see that He not only gave the organization, but He gave it work to do, to function collectively. And though there are about 12 different things specifically you can see in the New Testament that the Lord's church actually did as they functioned collectively, these fall into basically three different classifications or categories that we've used over the years, and I think accurately so. We talk about churches being involved in evangelism, edification, and benevolence. Basically, you're talking about a teaching function of the church, whether the saints or non-saints, and then you are talking about a work of benevolence that it is given to do as well. Now, the unity of the local church, as we all know, is to be carefully guarded and diligently maintained. We are to endeavor to keep the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. And that takes constant vigilance on the part of not only the elders, but the whole church to make sure that takes place. But there are some things I want us to notice about this as fundamental to what we're going to be reading in 1 Timothy chapter 3. First of all, the organization of the church, the local church, reflects the divine purpose that God has given to that church. Everything God designed, He designed with a purpose and then the wherewithal and organization to accomplish exactly what He wants accomplished. Now, this is certainly true when we look at the Lord's church. You can study the scriptural organization of the church, and that's going to help us learn more about the very purpose that God has given for the church. And we've noted many times before when talking about other subjects that when you start changing the work that God has given the church to do, when you start changing His purpose, what's it going to do? It's going to change the organization of the church. Every major apostasy among God's people since the establishment of the church on Pentecost, every major apostasy has developed because of a corruption in the organization of the Lord's church. It just has happened that way. And I want to suggest to you that the reason that happens is because, again, you change the purpose of the local church. You change the purpose of the local church, then the change of organization, just as sure as a dog wagging its tail, one's going to follow the other. Now, the New Testament pattern for the organization of the local church was also sufficient to do the work that God had given it to do, or God gave it to do. If you go back to the book of Ephesians, chapter 4, you can read where Paul said in verse 11, and he gave some as prophets and some as apostles and some as prophets and some as evangelists and some as pastors and teachers for the equipping of the saints, for the work of service, to the building up of the body of Christ. Of course, apostles and prophets, they were functionaries in the universal church. But then when you look at evangelists and pastors and teachers, these are functions within the local church, that functions within the realm of the local church. And these were given, both from a universal and a local standpoint, for the equipping of the saints. That's what our job as elders and preachers, evangelists, we're to do. That's the job of the teachers, to make sure that we equip everyone else for, he says, the work of service. We give them what they need in order to be able to go out and to serve God effectively. And when we equip the saints, when the saints are able to serve, then the body of Christ will be built up. I like particularly verse 16, where it says, from whom the whole body, being fitted and held together by what every joint supplies, according to the proper working of each individual part, causes the growth of the body for the building up of itself in love. So it's every joint doing its job, every individual part, that's going to make for the building up of the body of Jesus Christ. And so when we look at the New Testament church, the organization of the church was sufficient to do the work that God has given it to do. If the organization of the church cannot do a work that someone wants done, I want to suggest to you that's not the purpose of the Lord. They're wanting to do something else. Now, I also want to point out that each local church in the New Testament was self-governing. Acts 14 and verse 23, they appointed elders in every church. You see that in Acts chapter 20, also in verse 28. You see it in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 2, where the elders were to oversee the church of God, which was among you, the Apostle Peter said. And so elders were established in these local churches, and their work began and ended with that local church. Their work of oversight began and ended with the local church. And yet that church had all the governance that it needed in order to be able to accomplish the purpose that God designed the church to do. And then we want to also point out that because of this, you can see that each church was independent of any other, doing its own work without sacrificing its independence to any human organization or another local church. They collected their own resources, they made their own decisions, and they engaged in their own work. And so this is the organization that God gave to local churches. And it's the organization that reflects His divine purpose. It's the organization that is sufficient to do the work God has given it to do. It is not only sufficient, but it is self-governing, and it is independent of all other local churches. The wisdom of God can be seen in just a simple observation that if a false teacher arises, you deal with him locally and in the church where he is. If a false teacher is a part of some kind of denominational hierarchy, then his teaching would affect far more than just the local church. And so God's plan is always the best plan. Now, as we look at this, we're going to center our attention not so much on deacons as we are on elders tonight. And I'm going to borrow also from the list that Titus gives us as we talk about the various qualifications. Now, I do not have time tonight, and I think you know that, for us to go over all of the qualifications. And in fact, what I'm going to do is I'm going to observe the Passover on what we call the difficult qualifications, because there are other more important things I think we can do with an hour And if there are questions about any specific qualification you want to ask, don't hesitate to ask me after this is over. We'll be glad to go into that, and I'll be glad to tell you what I think about them anyway, although probably what I think about them won't be any different than what you think about them for the most part. There's some general things we want to notice about these qualifications that I think will help us as we think about the organization of the church. First of all, some of the qualifications are implied in the terms that are used to describe the work itself. For example, we use the term elder because that's the term you see in Titus 1 in verse 5. And it implies that a man is older and he's spiritually mature and he's experienced. And by the way, this word is really rich in Old Testament imagery. And you can go back and study some of the passages that Leon has mentioned and some even earlier than that, earlier than the divided kingdom. And you can see where the New Testament, the imagery for the New Testament elder comes from out of those Old Testament passages. Then there's the word shepherds or pastor, as is used in Ephesians chapter 4. And that literally means one who tends the flock and suggests that one has a proven and tender care for the people that are under his oversight. This is a function that deals with a person being a teacher and being a counselor and a helper. You know, sometimes over the years we have emphasized one of the terms above the others. For years, at least in my experience, you never really heard elders called shepherds. They were just always called the elders of a local church. Today, more and more you hear people emphasizing the idea of shepherding. And I think that's a good thing. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, because not only are these qualified men serving as elders and all the things that name implies, but there's also a function here of tending sheep, of knowing the flock and the flock knowing you, that is very important. And just here it would be good at your leisure to study Psalm 23 and Ezekiel 34 and John 10 in that light, to look at these shepherd passages and how they apply to this concept that we read about in the work of an elder. Then there's the word bishop. Let me back up here. There's the word bishop or overseer, which suggests that the man have the ability and the willingness to supervise others to whom he has delegated responsibility. And so there's a supervisory role here that the elders are to have. In some situations, I've known of people that thought that they were the ones that had to supervise the elders. Well, I'm not saying that elders are unaccountable, but the elders are the ones who are to supervise and superintend the flock. And then in Titus 1 and verse 7, there's also another word that's used there, and that's the word steward. An elder is a steward, and that suggests a manager of another's property, in this case, one who manages particularly spiritual truth and spiritual people. He's one who recognizably, on God's behalf, he's accountable to God, and he's going to have to do the things that God would have him to do and be faithful to that stewardship according to 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 2. So there are some qualifications that are mentioned or that are a part of the elder and the bishop, the pastor, just simply because of the names by which he is called. Then also, we want to make note of the fact that each man must be qualified to serve as an elder. This is not a matter of a group qualification thing wherein all men, when they're viewed correctly, possess all of the qualifications. I think it would be easy for a lot of churches to have elders if that were more so than there are today. There would be elders in just about every church if we could do things like that. But that's not the picture that we see in the New Testament. Each man has to possess each one of these qualifications. Titus 1 and verse 7 says that the overseer must be. And that's the same thing that you see here in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 2. An overseer then must be. And so he's going to, as you go down through this list here in 1 Timothy 3 and then over in Titus 1, you're going to see that these qualifications are requirements for the man to be able to reflect in his life if he's going to serve as an elder. Each man must possess each one of the qualifications before he is selected and appointed. Years ago, there was a man who wrote actually a book on the eldership, and in that book on the eldership, he basically advocated that you just appoint the very best that you have, and then you allow them to grow into the qualifications. Well, you know, it is true that anybody who's ever appointed an elder will tell you that he's going to grow pretty quick. He's going to do a lot of growing. In fact, it's kind of like, you know, when you have a baby, they grow an awful lot in that first year, right? Well, when you're an elder, you're going to grow up an awful lot in that first year of you serving as an elder. And you're going to keep growing because there's a lot of growth that's going to take place in a man who's going to serve and serve God correctly. But before he's ever appointed, there are qualifications that he must meet, and these are those that are listed here. And then I want to say that each man must continue to possess each one of these qualifications. You've heard sometimes people say once a man is appointed an elder, then he can't disqualify himself. He's always an elder. We've seen that, unfortunately, in our past. If an elder ceases to possess any one of these qualities, he becomes unqualified. And he needs to cease to be an elder. If he was appointed, he can be disappointed. I think I've heard that somewhere before. Just the idea of once an elder, always an elder, that concept is not scriptural at all. An elder can become unqualified. We're going to actually see that when we come to 1 Timothy chapter 5, because you're going to see how that it's possible in that passage for a man to become unqualified. Now, also, we want to make this observation, and that as we look at this list of qualifications, these qualities vary in their character. For example, some are absolute, and some require a measure of human judgment. Some require that you've got to exercise a level of judgment. And we'll say a couple of things about that. Well, as far as an absolute qualification is concerned, a man is either the husband of one wife or he's not. You know, there's no real in-between. He's either a husband of one wife or he's not. We may discuss what that qualification means, but either he is or he isn't. On the other hand, the quality of being hospitable, for example, requires the exercise of human judgment. One man may have a greater capacity for hospitality than another, but that does not mean that the first man is not hospitable. And so you have to exercise a level of human judgment with regard to whether you consider a man to be hospitable or not. And there are varying degrees of even some of the other qualifications, and we won't have time to go into all of that tonight. But I do want to make this observation about these qualifications where some require human judgment. I think there is such a thing as the collective judgment of a congregation. Using what I said just a few moments ago with regard to hospitality, you look at that qualification and you're going to judge whether or not you consider a man to be hospitable or not. You're probably going to have some people in a congregation who are going to think, well, maybe this, I don't really know if this man's hospitable. But on the other hand, perhaps the majority of the congregation will think, well, we do think he's hospitable. We've seen him exercise hospitality. Well, what has to happen in a circumstance like that? A collective will has to be established. A collective mind has to be addressed with regard to these qualifications. If a man is not thought to be hospitable by a considerable number in a local church, then for that reason, and that reason alone, maybe he shouldn't serve, if that is the case. And so you have to leave room for a collective will or a collective judgment when it comes to things of this nature. The qualifications look spiritually at every aspect of a man's life. We start looking at these qualifications. There's no area of a man's life that's not left untouched by them. These are going to address a man's character, and that's what he is. What he is when nobody else is looking. It's who he is. Then you're going to see that some of the qualifications address a man's reputation. That's what other people think he is. Some of the qualifications are going to address his domestic relations. Some are going to address his experience. Others his habits. Others his abilities. If a man doesn't possess some of the practical qualifications, sometimes that may not necessarily reflect upon his character, but it does say that he hasn't demonstrated them enough in order to be able to serve as an elder among God's people and over a local congregation. And I think, and I certainly hope, that these qualifications do not demand spiritual perfection in a person. I don't know of anyone who's ever reached that point to this date. I've never met him, and I didn't meet him, and that's Jesus Christ. And so no man that you're going to appoint to serve as an elder is going to be a spiritually sinless man. It's just not going to happen. He may reach a stage of maturity about him. Hopefully he has, but that doesn't demand perfection. And these qualities are attainable. I think sometimes we've talked about them so much as we've made people think, and particularly young men who would be wanting to eventually qualify themselves to serve, we sometimes make it seem like you've got to be some kind of super Christian to be an elder, that they're not attainable. Well, men in the first century met these qualifications, and in fact, but a very few exceptions, these qualities really are only the qualities of a mature Christian. Now, saying that, there's one other thing I'd need to say here too. You know, there are a lot more qualifications of an elder than those found in Titus 1 and 1 Timothy 3. The qualities to be a faithful Christian are qualifications for a man serving as an elder. Just because a fella can go down a list and check off most, if not all of these, does not automatically make him qualified to serve as an elder. Because sometimes there are other things that may only generally be viewed in these qualifications that would specifically be a problem. And may I add this, that these qualities are necessary to the work of an elder. And these qualities are necessary in order for that elder to perform his function, or this eldership to perform its function in the organization of the church as God has given it. In other words, these qualities have to be there in these elders, these overseers, these shepherds, in order for them to carry out not just their work, but for the purpose of God to be reflected in the church that they oversee. That's so very important, I think, for us to see. Now, with that in mind, what we want to do is just take kind of a quick look at the different categories of qualification, and we'll talk about them a little bit, each one of them, depending on how much time that we have. We begin, the qualifications that are related to his character, that's the longest list of qualifications when you put both 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1 together. There are 10 of them, and this is the longest list. And these qualifications, or these classifications, may be a little bit arbitrary, but yet I think you'll see the benefit of looking at them this way by the time that we're through. First of all, when we think about this, you're going to have a man that's going to have a desire to serve. A desire to serve as an elder. That means that he is going to, the word desire here carries with the idea of to stretch forth, and it's to reach after. So it is implying that here is a man who has, maybe from very early in life, has set aside a particular goal as to where and how he can serve in the kingdom of God. And this is something that he really, really wants to do. And so because he wants to do that, he's going to work all along to prepare himself for that. Here it implies not only desiring, but actually a seeking after, as in a work someone would work a lifetime to prepare for. Someone wants to embrace that. You know, it's unfortunate that over the years, I've run into a number of people who have said, and they might otherwise be qualified, but they would say, look, I don't want that job. I've never wanted to be an elder in a local church. I know one man who said, I saw what my father, who was an elder for many years, I saw what he went through in the local church where he was, and I never want that. And this is one of the finest men that I'd ever known. He still is to this day. But yet, he had no desire to serve. Well, you know, someone can't serve unless they really want to serve in this capacity. Now, the word implies an eagerness, but at the same time, not of an immoderate or unchristian-like character. Yeah, you know, there are some. When my boys were growing up, we coached baseball. I coached baseball. They played. I had an assistant coach one time who had an attitude that said, and he even said it one time out of my presence, he said, if I had the hammer, I'd do it this way. Yeah, okay. I wonder how many people have thought about the work of an elder that way. You know, if I can be an elder, then I can make the decisions, and it'll go the way that I think it needs to go. I hope we can all see the corruption that is in that kind of an attitude. I hope we can see how, while there is a place in a man's heart where he desires to serve God and to serve God humbly and to be a servant to the people of God, also because a man may want it for a reason that is not as holy as it otherwise should be. The word devout carries with the idea of, it's very closely akin to the word holy, and it carries with the idea of one who's set a certain direction in his life, and he separated himself from the world. This kind of person does what God says. He does it the way God says it. He does it with the right spirit that God would have him to have. And for that reason, he can be a pious person, a devout person. The word just carries with the idea of just being right and fair and fitting. It's more than just being generally righteous, but he's able to come to honorable decisions and equitable results in when there are problems that are faced. Gentle is another word. It goes back to something maybe that we've already talked about, where people have bad attitudes about desiring the work. Gentle is a spirit that is considerate. It is genial. It is forbearing. It's gracious. A gentleman is approachable. He's kind. He's mild, and he's fair. He may stand firm for his convictions and what he believes the truth is, but that doesn't make him a rough character. He's just simply humbly standing for what he believes to be right. The word peaceable is a word that carries with the idea of being reluctant to fight. You know, some people don't seem to be happy unless they've got some kind of brouhaha going all the time. Well, that's not an elder. An elder is looking for peace. He's trying to help people find peace. He's not the kind of man that's born in the objective case and kickative mood. He doesn't want to fight. He's not contentious. You know, when you've got a contentious person in the leadership, you know what that's going to do? It's going to destroy the peace of a congregation. The word temperate in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 2 carries with it the idea of being of sober mind. He can think seriously about serious things. It doesn't mean he doesn't have a sense of humor. It just simply means that he has the ability to be able to think seriously and soberly about what's before him. He gives calm and rational thought to whatever situations, whatever the situation may require. He's prudent, or as Titus says, he's sensible, which carries with the idea of moderation. This doesn't mean that an elder can't have, again, a sense of humor, but it denotes have a cautious, calm manner and approach, showing good sense in all the judgments that he does. Our English word means marked by wisdom and judiciousness, shrewd in management of practical affairs, having good common sense. And, you know, maybe that probably says it all with regard to this qualification, just having good common sense. But as Will Rogers said, sometimes common sense is not so common anymore. And so we understand the need that when a person is serving as an overseer over God's people, as a shepherd over God's people, this is serious business. And because of that, he's got to be prudent. He has to be sensible. He's got to be respectable. This is an interesting word because it comes from the same word from which we get our word for creation, to describe creation. It is orderly. It is well arranged. And it's a word that later came to, you can see it actually in the universe itself and how orderly and well arranged the universe is. We see it in women's clothing in 1 Timothy 2, 9 and 10 that we talked about a little earlier, talking about being orderly, well arranged on the basis of her character. Her clothing will fit her character. And now we're also looking at this word from a standpoint of the work of an elder and how his life is to be orderly and well arranged. I wouldn't quote this man on many things, but there's a man by the name of Sam Dawson said this about this particular qualification. This qualification describes a man who has organized and is living his life in a well-arranged manner. As you look at his family, his business, his job, his use of time, his conduct, his language, his habits, he does not conduct his affairs in a haphazard or careless fashion. A man who is never on time, behind with his payments, disorganized in his family and life, is not qualified to direct the affairs of the church. That's what it means to be a respectable individual. It's a person who has his life orderly and well arranged. Well, he's going to also love what is good, which means he's going to love good things and good people. They're going to have his heart. That's what he's going to be attracted to. That's what he is in the innermost being. He loves God's word. He loves good works. He loves men and good things. And he'll do all he can to encourage others in the performance of that which is good. William Barclay said, the Christian office bearer must be a man whose heart answers to the good in whatever person, in whatever place, and in whatever action he finds it. And I like that statement. Good things are what we want to emphasize and what we want to be a part of our lives. And then he's going to be self-controlled. This word implies a restraint exercised in our impulses and in our emotions. He's going to be able to control his temper, his tongue, his moods, his actions, and his habits. He's going to be self-controlled. We're going to come back to that just a little bit later as we talk about another one of the qualifications. So as we think about being self-controlled, these are the qualifications that basically have to do with character. This is what he is. That is at the basic level of his person. And then we're going to move on to the qualifications that are related to his reputation. In reputation, the man is going to be above reproach. That means that nobody's going to be able to take hold of anything in his life that they want to. It's not that there's not going to be somebody who's going to maybe at some time or another say something bad about him, but it's just that his life is going to be such that his character is proven. And he's shown to be above reproach when he is examined. There's going to be no valid accusation that's going to be made or sustained against him. His life is going to be so circumspect that it is not open to criticism. He's going to have a good reputation from those people that are without. And so he's going to have to be, to some degree, a personable person, someone that other people knows. And those people who know him are going to say, yeah, that's a pretty good fella. If you want to really know what kind of a reputation a person has, go talk to his next door neighbors. See what kind of a neighbor he is. You know, if you have a doubt as to whether or not somebody is of good reputation outside the church, that's a good place to begin. Now, sometimes your neighbor may be, a little bit weird and off-center and may not say anything good about you. But I think most of the time you look at the people that live around you, those people you come in contact with on a daily basis. They'll tell you what kind of a person this man is. And so there needs to be a good reputation from outside the church. By the way, how is it possible for us to have a spiritual impact, the spiritual impact we want to have outside the church, if we don't have a reputation, a good reputation from those outside the church? You know, we want to evangelize and we want to teach people the gospel. It all begins with who we are and who we display ourselves to be to the world. That word hospitable, we talked about it just a little bit ago, that literally means a love of stranger. And so an elder's one whose door is going to swing both ways. It may swing out, but it's also going to swing in as well. And he's going to be the kind of person who's going to be a people lover, and he's going to demonstrate that by the kind of life that he lives. He's not going to be pugnacious. In other words, he's not going to be violent. A leader in the church can't be one who reacts to difficulty with physical violence or sometimes you might even say even with pugilistic words. That can't be the kind of person that he is. Look, any elder I have ever known has had to face difficult circumstances. He's had to face times when either there have been people at odds with him or he's going to step in between two people who are at odds with one another. It's just going to happen. When that happens, sometimes he's going to be treated coldly. Ever been treated coldly? Sometimes he may be accused of being a little god or a pope or a dictator or a tyrant or something of that nature. And sometimes there are going to be people that are going to get in his face and going to invade his space. How you react at a time like that means the world. Because you can't give a person just as much as he sins. You can't respond to them in kind. God commands us not to be pugnacious people. He's free from the love of money. He's not covetous. It's a perverse it's a perversion of the corruption of the work of the eldership to be in it for money. I don't think I've ever known anybody who was in this work for money. The love of money is what is at the root of all motivation of false teachers. While money sometimes has to be a consideration, later on we're going to learn that in 1 Timothy 5 that an elder who labors hard in the teaching and the preaching of the gospel is worthy of double honor. So he's worthy of being paid for the work that he does. The truth of the matter is, he can't be in it for what he can get out of it. And very closely associated with that, Titus talks about the man who's not fond of sordid gain. And so he's referring to a person here who doesn't have honesty. He's not an honest person. He doesn't have any integrity about him. He seeks wealth and prosperity at any cost. And, you know, to think that this person can be out here in the world cheating people in business, and then all of a sudden he can come in and he can serve as an overseer of the people of God and accomplish God's desire, that's just a pipe dream. That's not going to happen. I saw this attempted one time. It's been over 40 years ago now. I'll never forget it. There was a man in a rural congregation out from where I was preaching, and it was a little institutional church, but it really didn't know it because it didn't have enough about it to be institutional of any kind, but that was their leanings anyway. But they had an eldership, and I remember one of the man's name, his name was Elvis. I'll never forget it. And his work was, he had a van, and he distributed magazines. And in the distribution of those magazines, guess what? At least one of the magazines was, one of them was Playboy. And he would go to 7-Eleven type stores, and he would stock their stock their stores. And he didn't see anything wrong with that. Well, I asked him. I had more courage then than I do now. I asked him, I said, "What? How do you do that?" He said, "Well," he said, "I know that reading those magazines, looking at those magazines are wrong, but I take pride in the fact that there are not as many sold on my route now as there were when I first started doing it." Well, that's a good thing. But if there's just one that I'm making money off of, then that's one too many. That's one too many. You can't be fond of sordid gain, getting your money just any way that you can. And so we've looked at the qualities of character and qualities of reputation. Let me just real quickly point out the domestic relations. It's sad but altogether true that this is the first place we come to when we talk about men who are qualified to serve an elder. It's the first place we come to. And it may be the easiest one litmus test to put up, at least the place to begin. But there's so much more that I think that we may overdo this one sometimes. Well, it's got to be a man, and that needs to be said in this day and age. It's kind of interesting that word for man here comes from the word taste, which means anyone, someone, but it is masculine in gender. It is masculine in gender. And the context is going to show that that is the case, because according to the next qualification, the husband of one wife. And the word husband here comes from the word that can only mean male. And he must be in the present tense, meaning that the man must be a married man. Now, why would we even have to mention this? We mention this because now churches of Christ are using women in public areas. Now, I have not heard of any as of yet that have actually appointed elders. They've been used in the pulpit. Have you heard of? All right, Leon says that there have been some that he know of that has been appointed as elders. I'm not aware of that personally. But I knew it was coming, and it's there because it's in every other religious group around us, and that's a part of the women's movement. Something we better get ready for because it's coming. He's got to be one who manages his own house well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. And the reason it's given is because if he doesn't know how to manage the church of God, doesn't know how to manage his family, how in the world is he going to manage the church of God? And his children are to be believers, not accused of dissipation or rebellion, Titus chapter 1 and verse 7. Then there are qualifications of experience, and these are that he's not to be a new convert, he's not to be a novice, and by the way, that word elder actually implies both age and experience. And in fact, in my looking into that word and its particular, its usage, it may very well emphasize the experience over the age, but the age is there and cannot be removed. Then there are qualifications as to his ability. He's going to be a man who's going to be able to teach, and that carries with the idea of skill, some level of skill. He's going to be able to exhort in sound doctrine. You can't exhort people in something you don't know yourself. And so there is the Apostle Paul emphasizing once again sound doctrine. He's going to have to be able to refute those who contradict. Now, this takes it a next step up. In other words, if there is a false teacher that comes in, he's going to have to know enough to be able to ascertain that this man is a false teacher, and he's going to have some level of ability to be able to reply to him. That's what it means to refute those who contradict. And he's going to be holding fast the faithful word, to hold firmly to cling to. How important that is when you go to Judges 2 and verse 10, and you read that there arose another generation who did not know the Lord. Just a short two generations after Joshua, now you've got people who do not know the Lord. I don't know what the next generation is going to be. I'll tell you here at South Coleman, as I'm sure is the case with you guys, we've got some of the finest young people coming up in another generation that I've ever met anywhere. But we never know what's going to happen to them. And we never know what's going to happen to their children. If it could happen to Israel, it could happen to us as well. And then there were qualifications that were related to his habits, among them not being quick-tempered, not being self-willed, and not being addicted to wine, which means he can't be a drunkard. Now, in Matthew chapter 25, if you'll give me just another moment or two, Jesus taught the parable of the talents. And over the years, I have taught from that passage, and I think accurately so, that passage tells us that ability plus opportunity equals responsibility, right? It does. And so men decide to serve. Men choose to serve. Now, it becomes the responsibility of every man, I think, to desire to serve God in the very best way that he can, to the utmost visibility and opportunity. That doesn't mean it's always going to feel good. That doesn't mean that you'll always necessarily want to do the things that you know you have to do. But it does, however, mean that you lay your life at the foot of the cross and you say, Lord, wherever, however, whenever you can use me, let me serve. Paul said, I have been crucified with Christ. And it is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself up for me. That should be our attitude as we go about to serve the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. I'm writing these things to you, hoping to come to you before long. But in case I'm delayed, I write so that you'll know how one ought to conduct himself in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and the support of truth. Let's never forget that that's what the church is. It is the pillar and the support of truth. Thank you for studying with me tonight. I appreciate your presence, as I know Leon does. And I tell you, I really appreciate being able to do this with Leon. Leon and I have never had the opportunity to do this kind of thing together. And it's a joy to be able to do that with him. And we just appreciate so much the fact that you would come and listen to our trembling lips and stammering tongues as we talk about the gospel. That's something that we all hold dear to our hearts. Let's take just a moment to go to God in a word of prayer before